Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, this is definitely one of the cooler episodes that I have ever had the pleasure of recording. I recently went on a trip from here in New Zealand, initially to Australia for a day, just to meet up with Hamish Hodder, who some of you may know from the YouTube channel with the same name, Hamish Hodder. We also met up with Brandon from the New Money YouTube channel. Both Brandon and Hamish have been guests on this podcast, so if you don't recognize them from YouTube, perhaps you recognize them from the podcast. And the three of us traveled all the way to the US to go to Omaha, Nebraska to attend the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting with Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, which was a ton of fun. Met a lot of people, obviously got to listen to the Berkshire Q&A in person and kind of see it live, which was definitely a very, very cool experience. If you haven't been to the Berkshire meeting before and you have any kind of aspiration to go before Charlie and Warren, I guess, are no longer there, which we actually cover a little bit in this podcast, which was kind of interesting. I would definitely recommend getting there and kind of just making it happen. Now, after we were in Omaha, we actually traveled to Texas for a little while, had a look around a couple of different places in Texas, and one of the cities that we stayed in was Austin, Texas, which happens to be the home of Matt Peterson, the guest for this episode, who runs Peterson Capital Management. Now, if you generally listen to these podcast episodes just on audio format, that's fine. I really appreciate everyone who tunes into these episodes. But this episode, we did do a really, really high quality video version with Matt, basically at his house in Austin. So head over to the video version on YouTube. It's just the Investing with Tom podcast. You should find a YouTube channel. And check out the video version of this particular episode if you're interested. Now, as far as what we covered, it was fairly wide-ranging. We covered, obviously, the Berkshire meeting itself because we did meet up with Matt there also. And we covered a range of other companies and kind of aspects of Matt's investing process. So we talked Seritage Growth Properties. We talked Alibaba, kind of some of the things that Matt has done with similar companies like JD.com, and also the reason why he thinks Charlie Munger has recently sold half of his Alibaba investment. We talked about investing in Turkey, and we also talked about Matt's option strategy as well. Now, Hamish actually co-hosted this one with me, so he got to ride along for this episode, which was a lot of fun, kind of having Hamish there helping me out for this one. And also a big shout out to Brandon, who ran the cameras and kept an eye on the audio and make sure we didn't run out of battery and made sure everything was recording and kind of running smoothly. So big shout out to those guys, and I think you will really, really enjoy this episode. So without further ado, let's roll it, and I hope you do enjoy. Right, we're here in Austin, Texas, with I guess two returning guests. Actually, we've got my man Hamish Hodder all the way from Australia. We've actually got Brandon from New Money, who you can't see. You might have heard him. he's running the cameras today, and we're in the Peterson Capital Management HQ with Matt Peterson. How are you going, Matt?
Thank you very much, Tom, Hamish. It's good to see you. And Brandon, it's nice to have you here. You know, I've been watching your shows for a while now, and it's great to be back.
Yeah, it's very cool. I think this is the first podcast I've done in person besides the one we did with you guys like last week. So this is quite cool.
Is that right? That's wonderful.
It's much better than staring at a screen. And I guess what brought us to the US in the first place was the Berkshire Hathaway meeting. So what was it like being back in Omaha after a three-year break?
Oh, you know, it's such a wonderful experience, this pilgrimage that so many have taken. I've been going to Omaha now since 2004.
Wow.
And so, you know, there were a couple years where I was in London, so I wasn't there during those meetings, but I've been to the rest of the 18 or so that were available to me. So it's really nice to be back. I have a whole lot of friends there. You always pick up a nugget or two of wisdom. And so it was fantastic.
Yeah. Is the weekend generally pretty similar year to year that over the 15 odd years that you've been going? Because we've just attended our first one. So
Yeah, it evolves. That, yeah. It evolves over time, actually. So right. and it's getting better and better. You know, even the venue itself has gone through like three corporate name changes
right.
since I yeah. started attending. But there are more and more events. You know, we've started hosting this barbecue that you attended, mm-hmm. And so there are more events. It's becoming more full, and the message that you receive from Charlie and Warren is changing. And now you get, you know, Greg Abel on the stage, you get a mm-hmm. G. Jane on the stage. So certainly it's improving every year, and we just had the 3-year hiatus. So this was a big jump.
Yeah, it was pretty cool to be there. I was surprised actually about the number of sort of surrounding events. I thought it was kind of just going to be the one day at Berkshire, but there's so much going
on. Yeah, I really didn't know what to expect, I think, going into it, but it makes perfect sense that you have all these value investing and even different companies like Markel who run their Q&A there. It makes a lot of sense that everyone kind of congregates over this weekend. But yeah, it was fascinating to see. And yeah, we went to the barbecue that... How long have you been doing the barbecue for?
You know, we've been doing the barbecue for, I guess, probably 5 years now.
Yeah, right.
But 2 years it wasn't in person. So those years it didn't exist. It started just by accident where a couple of friends showed up for a barbecue and we weren't having a barbecue. And then we thought we should formalize it. So now we get the professional staff in there to help us. And cool. And the turnout's pretty great. We do it the Thursday before. So not everyone's there. But the VIPs are there. So people who are there for the barbecue are there with a purpose for the meeting. So you end up with a really nice crowd.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt kind of, I wasn't quite sure what to expect, like who was going to be there and what kind of people, but there was like quite a wide variety of people. There was a lot of content creators there actually,
yeah.
which surprised me and was kind of creators. A bit of a relief. I think like Brandon, I was like worried that it was just going to be all like fund managers and I'm just going to be here, this 23-year-old kid like, hi.
Yeah.
But no, it was great to just, you know, network and chat
Absolutely.
With different people.
A lot of fund managers there as well. Vitaly Katznelson mm-hmm. was there, who I think you're familiar with, and like Alex Rublikava, who now runs a VC fund, was there, and quite a few people. In fact, a lot of Guy Spear's staff was there.
Yeah.
Guy had a meeting that he had to attend, so he wasn't able to be there. But in the past, he's actually co-sponsored it, so we've mm-hmm. done it together. It's a great event.
Yeah, it's cool. Jake Taylor dropped by from Valley.
Jake, yeah,
hours.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. The Rebel Allocator.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In fact, there was quite an interesting comment from some of the ladies. I was speaking to some of the ladies. And then they were very distracted, and they pointed out that Jake Taylor had just walked in. Oh, I didn't, you know, I know, yeah, he's a great guy. You know, they said, no, he's no offense, but they said, you know, he's the Brad Pitt of podcast.
Yeah, that's a compliment. I definitely haven't received that one. Although you've received some, you're the Joe Rogan of the investing podcast space.
Apparently, well, according to Guy, he just likes to build everyone up.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, over the weekend, I guess, man, like what were some of your key takeaways, I guess, from the meeting? A lot of similar topics or categories, I guess, were spoken about this year, with a lot about inflation. And, was there anything in particular, I guess, you just drew away from the meeting this year?
Look, there are a few things, because I've been in attendance for so long and I've been studying Berkshire for so long, a lot of the questions have been answered in the past. And so, but it's nice to have that consistency to be reinforced. One of the interesting aspects, there's a couple of interesting aspects, but one of the interesting aspects that I took away was that they deliberately pointed out that if they could buy more of their shares, if they could buy back stock or go out and buy an external business, their preference is to buy an external business. So these, you know, Charlie and Warren are still building their empire, mm-hmm. and they still want to expand. So, you know, they know Berkshire so well. I wouldn't have been surprised if they had said, we'd love to just buy back our stock. It's our favorite company. We've built it. And if we get Berkshire cheap, it's better than anything else. But actually, they're still trying to expand and grow Berkshire, which is, I think, a really good sign. So they're buying back all the shares, but they'd still like to be allocating capital and growing. So that's pretty important.
Yeah. And, kind of caught me off guard a little bit. They've been like slowly building up this massive like $150 billion in cash, and they've all of a sudden spent like 40 of it, right?
What do you think billion, of that? And then they're going to always keep 20 and probably a little more than 20. So yeah. They spent,
they're getting down, like,
well, they're yeah. down to 100, maybe.
He's down to his last 100
yeah
billion.
Last 100 billion, yeah.
Yeah. And there's headlines about everything else that he's buying, and so it's interesting. He also talked a little bit about Activision,
mm-hmm.
Which was an amazing little purchase, but he pointed out this is the same workouts he used to do in the 60s, yeah, where he's just doing like a corporate structure sort of ARB, and yeah, he expects Microsoft to be able to make the purchase because they have cash on the balance sheet. So he's just going to collect some you know, a bit of a gain here until the deal closes. So yeah, it's, yeah, you know.
Well, it's quite significant on that particular deal. I think it's like, what, a 20% upside between the stock price now and 95. Yeah. Do you do any of that through your fund? Have you dealt with those kind of situations before? Or is that just something you don't do?
We will do small opportunistic things, certainly.
Yeah.
But it's really not the core of the business. The core of the business is our long-term value portfolio. So yeah, mm-hmm, we're buying these great businesses run by great managers, buying them for great prices, and then really just trying to hold on to these for the long term. Yeah. In fact, like an infinite time horizon, ideally. So, so we do a little bit of that, but not that frequently.
Yeah, yeah, cool. It is cool to see Buffett going back to like his, yeah, what he was doing in the 50s and 60s. It's kind of crazy. You read some of his very old letters, and he's talking about how, you know, he's starting to get some advantage out of getting bigger when he's managing like, you know, a couple million bucks or whatever. Yeah. And then the story obviously flipped the other direction that, you know, we've got too much money and not enough ideas.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that like those opportunities would exist,
yeah,
at that scale. You'd think that those would have been arbed away.
It's quite incredible. Yeah. But I think, you know, fear and greed, just the herd mentality just pushes even billion and almost $1 trillion businesses to extremes. So they've been able to find these opportunities. But certainly it's much, much easier if you're dealing with small cap companies that are less scrutinized than, you know, something like even an Activision or some large cap. It's just they yeah, just tend to be much more frequently mispriced.
Mm. Yeah, you can't really, I don't really think that many people do this anyway, but you can't really look at Buffett's cash position and say, oh, he's sitting on so much cash, you must think there's some kind of event coming. You can't really do that because, of course, he's the scale that he's operating at is just so different to even the average person or even a moderate fund.
Yeah.
Just the different opportunities that are available. I think I've run like some approximate maths a few times, like $150 billion, is if he was going to pile that into a couple of companies, there's literally just a handful of businesses that are actually available to him,
yeah,
where he won't be buying more than 10% of the stock, for example. So it's, yeah,
couldn't agree more. In fact, from his perspective, he'll move markets, and if, yeah, he buys more than 10% and has to, yeah, file, everyone's going to know and the price is going to change.
Yeah.
His cash position, he's playing an entirely different game.
Yeah.
If you look at even Daily Journal, where you know Munger is running the portfolio, they're just fully invested. And Munger even pointed something out at the Daily Journal meeting where he said he's never in his life, you know, he's 98 years old, he's never in his life sat around with cash waiting for an opportunity. So even if you're dealing with many millions and even tens of millions, I think even beyond hundreds of millions, you should be putting all your cash to work, because there's plenty of opportunities to put $10 million into a certain undervalued security.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So I presume based on that statement that you try and be fully invested in your fund most of the time.
Yeah.
How does that work with, I'm curious how that works with the flow of funds coming in and out from investors. If money's coming in and say you have a number of positions, but none of them are at the dirt cheap prices that you might have been buying them previously, how do you kind of navigate that? Do you just spread across evenly? Are you buying?
Yeah.
Are you selling puts? What kind of approach are you doing with the money that's kind of flowing in, that's out of your control in a way?
Absolutely. Great question. So first of all, we do keep a cash position because we have the strategy where we sell puts. And mm-hmm. so those, a lot of times that's allocated to the puts that we've already sold.
It's essentially collateral though.
It's collateral. Not, yeah. That's right. It's collateral. But we have a modest sized fund, right? There's 20 million-ish. So if we say have a new LP that joins and puts in $3 million, we can be really patient with that capital. So there's nothing that's putting pressure on us to buy, but we have these compounders that I know extremely well. And you know, one or two of them might be inexpensive and it will allow us to allocate additional capital. So we can allocate capital to the positions we already own, or we might be watching some new positions and allocating there. But it's very, very easy to allocate $3 or $5 million to a good position, especially when you're selling a put, which gets kind of magnified, you know, 100x, because every contract represents 100 shares.
Yeah.
So it's quite easy. It doesn't take long to allocate capital, but we can be very patient. So even a 3 million, suddenly we have 15% cash or something. That's not an anchor for us. And within a few months, or even if it takes a few quarters, that will get allocated to a good investment opportunity.
Hmm. Yeah. I think you mentioned in one of your videos that at your size, there's more opportunity. You have more ideas than capital to put to work.
More ideas than capital. Because in the smaller space and even the larger space, but if you're looking globally, there's an opportunity somewhere. There's a dynamic or an event that's occurred and put a great company in the gutter somewhere. And so you just need to be sort of watching everything, and you can deploy the capital. Buffett has an entirely different problem. So it's and he has to be very careful with the signals that he's sending to the world.
Yeah, it's been pretty impressive how, like, you know, you go back to letters literally decades ago at this point, and Buffett's talking about how scale is going to slow him down, but I think he's still beat the index over like 3, 5, and 10 years now.
He's done an impressive job. I mean, I think Apple probably has driven a lot of success over the last 5 years. That was a large company that still had a lot of room in it to be quite a significant compounder, I think, at least so far. So having that as, 40% of his portfolio.
Yeah, and I think he's added a little bit. He mentioned in the meeting. Were you surprised by any of the things that he's bought recently?
I wouldn't say surprised. He's always... look, he's buying a lot of Occidental. He bought into Activision. He's buying
Chevron.
I think, and he's allocating to Apple. He knows he needs to be in very big spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So he can go in a big way into energy, and a big way into technology, and a big way into insurance, and have and be able to allocate tens and potentially hundreds of billions. But there's different industries where he just can't push that hard. So I wasn't really surprised with where he allocates capital. There's only because his opportunity set is so small, we're sort of aware of where the capital is probably going. I mean, last year, what was it? Maybe I want to say 26 billion that got just put into repurchases at Berkshire. So these are pretty obvious major strokes, but they really enhance the long-term performance of the security.
Yeah. Yeah. It was fascinating to see, because on his Occidental purchase, how he was talking about how volatile it was, that what did he get? He got 14% ownership in the company within 2 weeks or something, which is insane, especially for the size of the position. You would think that, like you were saying before, most of the time he'll move the market if he's pushing like that. So
And what he's also referring to is there needs the volatility helps, but it's the turnovers of the shares.
Mm-hmm.
He can't buy every share that's being sold. So if they're buying a third of the shares on a volume on a daily basis, the turnover has to be so immense. So it must be full of transactional traders, speculators, because I think he pointed this out, that they could never accumulate 14% of Berkshire over that period because the turnover doesn't exist.
Yeah, and it was like, 40% of the stock's already gone to index funds.
Yeah.
So you've only got 60% to work with, and somehow he managed 14%.
Yeah.
He was kind of saying something.
He was quite surprised, I think.
I mean, he was saying something similar. I guess it was 2020 when he was getting out of the airlines. It was like, he was almost, seemed like he was laughing about how quickly he was able to get out of that.
How many buyers there were of something that clearly looked like it was going to have some headwinds.
Have a rough time.
Okay. Was there any other takeaways that, he invested in about 7 different companies. Actually, one thing, I'm not sure if you have any insight on this, but I heard somewhere that he also invested in some German companies during the quarter. That's all I've heard. And I don't know if.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly what he was buying, but because these international purchases don't show up on 13 F's. And so you need to, it needs to sort of filter through. So I'm not sure exactly what he was buying, but of course it would not be surprising at all to learn that he's making international investments. I thought one of the, because there's been a 3-year hiatus, there were some, I think, newcomers to the meetings like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I found it amusing. how many people were sort of speculating on how much more time these guys have. In fact, so many people said, well, it's they're actually assuming it's probably the last year. And I'm not overly optimistic. I recognize their age. They're not going to be around forever. But these are two healthy individuals working hard in their old age, surely surrounded by the greatest medical treatment.
Not the greatest diet, though.
No, not the greatest diet. Yeah,
what's in the peanut brittle?
We've got to be demolishing See's candy.
Yeah. We've got to be shipping more of that in.
Well, so I mentioned to you guys just before this, I have this actuarial table. So I came back to look because it's been a little while since I've heard everybody saying it's their last year. And the table's from 2006, so it's a little out of date. But it says if you're 98, on average, you have 3.4 years. If you're 91, you have on average 5-point-something years. So I think it's highly likely we have a few more of these meetings. And I don't think these are your average American citizens. Yeah, so they could have a few years left. Anything can happen. But hopefully they're around for a little while longer than some people expect.
Yeah, I hope so. I think we came just with the idea that, yeah, they are getting a lot older and, you know, we just want to make the most of it. But we would love to come back here every year for as long as we can.
There will be a final year. I'm just not certain that it was this year.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is good to start seeing some of the other guys up there like Greg and Ajit, although they, answered one question or something.
Yeah, it was one question in the first session or something.
Yeah. I'd love to see Ted and Todd up there. I don't know what you think about
that. Of course, it would be wonderful. I think Buffett's really working hard to shield them from the public view so that when he's gone, they don't suddenly have to start justifying a whole bunch of holdings because it can be distracting and it can bias your thoughts in general. So he's trying to keep them under the radar and just have Greg and Ajit running the show.
Any other takeaways from the meeting? There was a lot of talk about inflation. I think someone mentioned an article that Buffett had written in 1977 about inflation swindling the equity investor. I actually hadn't read that article before, so I went back and read it, and it was really fascinating to see him break down all of the different ways in which most stocks actually are very similar to bonds in that they don't really offer too much protection against the inflation, that businesses aren't able to increase their return on equity or whatever. In order to outpace inflation. So I thought that was really interesting. And then I think in the meeting, he kind of went into a discussion. It was kind of from a personal perspective, but I guess it applies to businesses too, that you want to be exceptional at something in order to be able to charge whatever a higher price during inflation. And I think that obviously, I think he was talking to the girl specifically about her personally, but it applies to businesses as well in terms of having some kind of deep moat that allows you to have pricing power. So I thought that was interesting.
It was absolutely great advice. When equities are still the place you want to be, but you need to be sort of doing your bottom-up analysis and identifying opportunities where they have pricing power, they can pass along the increased cost to their customer base without losing their customer base. And so it's very important to do bottom-up analysis. I think for folks that are just blindly investing in the S&P 500, I think there's going to be a lot of headwinds here over the next few years. So it's a challenging time, and he's pointing that out. But yeah, investing yourself, you can raise your own prices. So if you're the best performing lawyer or attorney in some state, it doesn't matter what you charge. And if there's inflation, you just move along with it. So. I thought his comments on crypto, although they're not changed from before, it was quite dramatic. And there's a few of us. I actually set up a little Coinbase account, and I have intention of purchasing a little Ethereum, mostly to watch.
Absolute sin.
But yeah, it's so, you know, Buffett saying he wouldn't buy all the Bitcoin in the world for, I think he said $25 billion or something.
I think he might if someone offered him all the Bitcoin.
Think he literally said $25, didn't he?
Yeah, he said $25.
Oh, did he say $25?
Yeah.
I just assumed it had a B at the end.
It was like 20 bucks.
He said $25. Yeah.
Oh. Really?
Yeah,
I'll have to go back and watch that.
Yeah.
Because that seems, I mean, that's so extreme. I mean, he's clearly trying to make a point.
Yeah,
and if he wasn't, I think he has to really communicate to the masses. And in doing so, he's trying to protect people from speculating on this sort of these products. Yeah. I don't think it's a sin to have a little small yes. piece. We don't have it in our fund, for example.
Yeah.
And I've made that clear to our investors. But if you want to have a little crypto on the side, I think that's okay. It's a diversified product and it's been doing just fine.
Mm.
And I think for some of them, like in Ethereum, you know, that's the rails of the future of Internet 3.0. So in fact, the protocols can produce something. So I don't know all of the details. There's experts out there that do. But I just find it amusing that they still are so bearish.
Yeah.
Against this.
Very extreme.
Yeah, I guess there's like the investment point of view where it's a non-productive asset, and then there's the technology, just the underlying technology, I think clearly has value, and maybe they misunderstand that or they just don't care because they don't care about that perspective. But I think certainly I don't really know that much about crypto, but certainly from things that I've seen, the technology is going to continue to be used in ways we don't really understand. But from an investment perspective, I guess it kind of falls in the same camp as gold, as maybe you want to add diversity, but it doesn't produce anything. So it's difficult to reach any kind of intrinsic value.
There's definitely a lot of speculation. I sometimes wonder if Charlie's talking to his army of grandkids when he's saying these things that are, I don't know, presumably going to get billions of dollars.
don't put my money in Bitcoin. Yeah. Don't you dare.
Yeah, well, there's just a lot of speculation, I guess. And it's hard to understand what the future's going to look like.
Yeah, I'm sure there was probably quite a lot of similar discussion around the internet when it was early 90s or mid 90s and late 90s. There was a lot of, obviously, companies that were terrible businesses that didn't produce cash flow. You could probably see them in a similar light.
Yeah.
But the underlying technology, you could probably see that it was going to develop into something, whether or not you could see what it would be.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. We should switch to something we know more about.
Away from crypto.
Knows more about that. One of the things, so this is your second time on the podcast, one of the things we talked about in depth quite a bit was options. That's sort of another area that I think traditionally has a lot of speculation, but definitely not the way that you're using it. We got talking at, I think it was the Guy Spier William Green meet and greet in Omaha about like this story with your experience with JD.com, where you're putting up, I think, relatively small amounts of capital, you'll be able to explain it to us. But what's the story with JD.com and that experience of I think was selling puts buying calls?
It's a very good question. So JD.com sells an ADR in America, which allows us to buy it quite easily through the standard market. You can buy it through the New York Stock Exchange, but part of our strategy is to purchase things for the lowest price we possibly can. And so we use a structured value approach where we write a put as a tool to own the underlying equity. There was a legal issue. So JD.com has a number of warehouses and done all the logistics and is similar in many ways to an Amazon and a FedEx here in America, existing over in China. And at one point, the CEO got in some trouble. It was like headline news and the share price was plummeting. Part of the Black-Scholes model is volatility. So volatility kind of feeds into the price of these option contracts. And when volatility is very high, the premiums of both puts and calls go up. Because there's more uncertainty, people want more premium for the perceived risk that they're taking. The way that we use these is very different than the way that most of the market uses them. So as people are speculating or trying to sort of buy a call to sort of leverage their gain, or they're trying to buy a put because they're scared of a security, so they're buying a put when they're fearful and they're buying a call when they're really euphoric, we're taking the opposite side of that trade. So as there were these headline risks and exposure for JD, the price fell way below what would be even a reasonably consideration for a intrinsic value of JD. And during that period, it was an interesting time. It was almost it's a pretty advanced approach, but instead of just selling the puts, where we picked up an enormous premium, we were selling out of the money puts, we used a little bit of that premium to then turn around and buy some out of the money calls, because These went out a couple of years, and we had a long time horizon. We're very patient investors, but we basically were able to purchase these calls ultimately for free. So we took the put premium in, we bought a few out of the money calls, and by the time the calls had expired, the shares had gone from about $20 a share to 90. So we had a certain amount, maybe a 8% exposure in our fund, but those calls went up, you know, just enormous amount. We end up with a great return. In fact, we had exited with covered calls before even the original calls had converted to stock. So we basically did the whole transaction over about a 2+ year period.
Wow.
And it was sort of infinite return because we didn't put any capital up.
Yeah.
But
that's crazy.
It was a small position that turned into a very reasonably sized position and was sort of just free money.
Wow. And did you end up getting put any of the shares, or did it?
We were not put any of the shares.
It was basically just moving up. So you weren't put any of the shares. You just took the premium, and then the premiums actually covered the entire premium of the call options you were buying.
That's right.
That's insane.
And without getting into too much detail on it, there's a lot of controversy around, it's a controversial sort of topic, but in my view, you can do pretty much the same thing with BABA right now. So because volatility is so high and because contracts go out multiple years based on a number of different parameters, if you're comfortable with the risks and things that you're taking in terms of political risks, et cetera, I think you're in a good position to pull off something similar with BABA.
Right. Okay. And then typically when you're writing these put option contracts to kind of enter a position, how are you kind of structuring that? Are you doing kind of like staggered over different time periods, some in the money, some out of the money? Like what does that kind of look like for your fund?
So it's such a good question, because as you start applying this rigorously, you start to realize that you get all sorts of ways to sort of diversify and almost cost average through these products. So you can adjust your strike price. You can adjust the premium that you're willing to accept, so you can sell for a variety of prices. You can also adjust your expiration date. So if you, ultimately, I end up building sort of a three-dimensional matrix, and we're selling things with different strike prices, four different prices that expire at different times. And if there's a contract that, say, is going to expire with a strike of 100, and we have contracts expiring in 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, and 24 months, we may end up with some where we buy and some that expire and we don't buy. And what that means is ultimately, within that same position, we've really lowered our cost basis down to a very low price per share. So if we're trying to buy 1,000 shares, if we're willing to buy 1,000 shares, but we end up with 500 of those shares, we may have picked up $20 in premium on each contract. So it sort of become, if we pick up only half, we've now sort of picked up 40 on that half. So instead of buying for 100, if that's the market price, we're in for 80, or maybe we're in for 60, but it's a very valuable tool. So we structure it with this sort of matrix in mind, where we take our full notional exposure that we'd wish to have. And at the end, as things expire, we can always write more contracts if it still provides us with adequate IRR.
Yeah. Okay. And obviously, I think with option contracts, they're in buckets of kind of 100 shares. So this is probably having the three-dimensional matrix that you're talking about is something that kind of comes with some level of scale, I guess. Was this something that, I think your fund started with $100,000
yeah.
a few years ago? So were you still using put options? And of course, I would imagine that the matrix wasn't as complex, but how did you kind of go about structuring your put options when you were relatively smaller?
That's a great question. so we launched with 125,000. Within a few months, we had over a million and that type of thing. But even with a million, it's sort of difficult because you're let's say you're willing to have only 10 positions, you still need to allocate 100,000,
mm-hmm.
Which but you can build out the matrix with that size, as long as you're dealing with it depends on the price of the underlying stock. So if you're dealing with a Berkshire or a Google, or Netflix or Tesla, your notional becomes very large, because the price of the underlying shares are expensive. So you can do it with one put contract, though. You don't need to wait till you can build out the whole matrix. If you want to buy the shares, I started implementing this in about 2005, and it happened very organically for me. I was working out on Wall Street, and I was working with all these different trading desks at Goldman Sachs, trying to work out these models and things for them. And I just recognized that it was so silly to buy through the New York Stock Exchange when I could sell a put contracts and get put the shares. So it would just make it, I could just buy it for less than the retail investor. And I didn't have millions of dollars back then. So I was doing it with a small amount of capital, and I would just simply sell one or two put contracts on the shares I want to hold. And it still wasn't any form of speculation. Once we receive the shares, we're long-term buy and hold investors, just like Warren and Charlie. And so we were building out this portfolio. We think of ourselves as owners, and we'll hold those shares for a long time. But even with one put contract, there's an advantage. You lower your cost basis before below the retail price of a stock.
Right. And you're typically doing selling calls on the way out as well to sell
right.
for a higher price as
that's
well.
That's right. So again, just sort of generic scenario, if instead of it costing 100, you get a $20 premium and it costs you 80, when those shares go up to 400, you, instead of selling for 400, can now turn around and maybe sell with a strike of 450 and pick up another $30 and be out at 480. Mm-hmm. So the shares may never go to 480, and they maybe never dropped all the way to 80. But and I'm sort of trying to create easy math for myself. But instead of buying for 100 and selling for 400, you'd make 300%. Instead, you're in for 80 and selling for 480. I guess you'd make 500%, like 6x, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a very real tangible advantage. I mean, your portfolio, if you've had $1 million, instead of it being now 400 million, now it's 600 million. So it's real money.
Crazy.
It's mind blowing.
Yeah. I highly
recommend you implement this in your own portfolio.
We were talking about this last night, and Hamish has been digging into Netflix a lot lately.
Yeah. It's like, kind of been a bit of a rabbit hole for me. I'd heard about this strategy from a couple of different people. Phil Towns spoken about it, and a few other people mentioned it to me that I should be looking into this. And I never really kind of gave it any thought. And then, I watched a couple of your videos, and your explanations just kind of, I think through your podcast as well, just kind of resonated with me. And like yesterday, I was just kind of staring out the window for like running numbers. Like, okay, if the stock goes to here, this is what happens. If the stock goes to zero, this is what happens. Just kind of running it through. So it's really fascinating. In terms of the selling, just to kind of stay on that point, are you always looking to, do you have like an exit point in mind? Like, are you the kind of person to buy at a 50% discount, and once it reaches intrinsic value, you're out? Or is it a great company, you want to hold that over forever, ideally? How do you kind of navigate that? And is it different for business to business?
I think it's different from fund to fund. For different fund managers, they approach this differently. But we are so selective. We run such a concentrated portfolio that I try to identify and incorporate in the portfolio only the very best businesses. And frankly, there's an evolution to many fund managers' career. Oftentimes we start more as CPAs, and we're looking for the Ben Graham net nets, and we just, and unfortunately a lot of them become value traps, and we learn the hard way. But you buy into certain businesses that just don't have the growth potential as others, and so you do need to sell with an intrinsic value. So when I buy, I know that there's a discount to intrinsic value. I know what I expect the value of this company to be. However, if it is indeed a great business model, as it approaches that price, I am very hesitant to sell. It is actually very rare that we sell. It would have to go so far beyond the intrinsic value, because what happens is, our very simple framework is to look at the greatest business models. So today that might be a low capex SaaS business or something. So the greatest business models at the time, the greatest management teams, so that as times change, they can also steer the ship in the right direction. And then a really great value. So not overpaying, but if you really get great management and great business model, it's going to maybe cost something. So when you're looking for that, if you really get into that perfect intersection, you almost don't want to ever sell. It's, you know, you'd be, what do they say? You're cutting the flowers to water the weeds. Yeah. And it becomes difficult because you get big run-ups and you might have a portfolio that seems a little imbalanced.
Weighted.
But one example that occurred to me recently was just this whole Naspers process,
yeah.
10-cent situation. Imagine if Naspers was just always selling their 10-cent because it didn't fit their, it was no longer in balance. What they just became
yeah.
a conduit to 10-cent because they never touched it. So, yeah. So ideally you never have to sell. But obviously if something is in far in excess of intrinsic value, we would use a covered call to exit.
Yeah. And I guess it kind of differs if you're an individual and maybe running a fund, maybe you can speak to this. I guess there's different pressures as well. I mean, you might, as an individual, you might want a stock to run up to 90%, or you maybe you're just comfortable with that. But with investors, maybe that's just not the best fit for your particular fund. Is that something that kind of plays a role?
I think that does play a role. I think most, it's common tendency is to turn over your portfolio too quickly. So I think it's much more important to put up the guardrails so that you don't need to sell.
Yeah.
I think selling too early is a really common error,
mm-hmm.
very common error. And so I talk about a lot in the writings and annual reports and now even with you, but we call our compounders infinite compounders, and they're not going to go to infinity, but we have no time horizon on these. We are going to hold them, forever. But in a fund, you do receive some pressure, some external pressure to look like you're doing something.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to sit there with seven or eight compounders for year after year after year, you know, people start to question it, but it is the best approach. And by the way, we were talking about the meaning. Munger and Charlie have mastered this. I mean, they've just stood there holding Coca-Cola
yeah.
and earned almost no returns for 2 decades. Yeah. And they're still happy to sit on it.
Hmm. Yeah. And at the same time, I mean, they've been sitting on Apple forever. They've been sitting on American Express forever.
Yeah. Or Costco in the Daily Journal yeah. portfolio. So yeah.
It reminds me of the Nick Sleep Nomad partnership.
Yeah,
they just held Berkshire, Costco, and Amazon forever.
Yeah,
they said, "Hey guys, we've done nothing this year, and we think it's a great.
Yeah,
we think we did very well."
Yeah, they held those three for almost a decade, closed the fund, and then I think Nick Sleep continued to hold just those three for almost another decade, and I think Amazon eventually was like 70% of his wealth. So he eventually decided that was enough. Enough's enough. But Yeah, that's insane. Just three positions. I think, Amazon was, 100 bag almost or something like that, which is insane.
it's interesting. And it's, you know, every time that you make a new investment decision, you have a new probability of making a mistake.
Hmm.
And you really don't know the new opportunity as well as you knew your existing opportunity. So, you know, as an example, we've held Daily Journal here for a couple years, exceptional business model, exceptional management team, and an extraordinary price. It would almost certainly be a mistake for me to exit that and then move the capital into something else. There would be a tax liability. We would immediately start with a haircut because we'd have to pay the taxes on the gains that we've made, and we wouldn't know all of the risks affiliated with the new firm. So I constantly receive negative feedback from viewers or readers that question, you know, what is the IRR of this potential? How do you really think it's going to be above 15%? Could that be justified against the potential with, say, you know, their favorite flavor of the month,
yeah,
call it Netflix or something, certainly you'll get more out of Netflix than Daily Journal. Perhaps that's the case in the short term, maybe in the long term, but you can sleep so well at night knowing every single detail about a firm, mm-hmm, and I'm very confident it outperforms, and we have great management team, great personnel throughout the organization. It's going to take a lot more than, concerns about the next 12 months for us to change that position. We'll do quite well over the long term,
yeah,
with it.
Yeah. There's a couple of things there. I feel like, people tend to get a lot of like false sense of precision from spreadsheets. Like, you know, this is going to do 15, you're in something that's going to do 13, but the business world's, it's not that clean in real life. And, I feel like every great investor you ever talk to, their number one mistake is always, I sold something too early. Like, it's never, you hear the stories about, we made this mistake, this company had too much debt, it went to zero for whatever reason. But the biggest mistakes are like, oh, this is my long list of stuff that went up 20 times after I sold it. Yeah, so
sold it up to 3x and it went 20x.
Yeah, exactly.
You may appreciate this. I talk to both professional and smart retail investors every day. And I hear quite frequently people will tell the story about how they bought Apple for XYZ price. Yeah. They bought Amazon at this price. And I'll listen to this explanation. And then I ask them, so when did you sell it? And then they say, okay, so I sold it at this price. And clearly the vast majority made a huge mistake. And so they maybe made 3X and they're bragging about their purchase price, but they actually sold it,
after a double or something.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So selling is often, it is such a big and underappreciated error in this business.
And I think over the long term, even great businesses are going to go through periods where there's a lot of negative sentiment about that business. So in hindsight, you look back and you go, oh, I held Apple for 3 years, but maybe I think it's very difficult, especially if you don't understand the business fundamentally, to hold the business through periods of turbulence, to have the confidence to say, I understand this is a great management team. They're being honest. They've got good return on capital. This is the long term for the business. Understanding those things and not getting spooked in the short term, I think is kind of something you don't really see when you just look back at Amazon and go, oh, it's 100 bag. Of course they were going to go that big. They had a lot of periods where they were not profitable and ran debt and all of these things going on. Yeah, so
they didn't always have AWS.
No, exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd have to look up the exact numbers, but I think, I remember in a past meeting, Buffett said something like he's 85% Fisher and 15% Graham. And it was Fisher who said something along the lines of, if you've done your homework properly before you buy, the time to sell is almost never. And it's because when you get these great business models, when you get a great business model, you've got a lot of cash flow. And when you got a great management team, they know what to do with that cash flow. And so when you're in the business world, there's a lot of competition. It's ruthless out there. So if you're finding bumps in the road, what you really need is a management team that can steer the ship and navigate through these difficult times. And hopefully they'll outperform all their competition and their peers, and they'll be, once they make it to the other side, there'll be less competition and they can continue to grow. They could even pivot the business. You saw Daily Journal went from newspapers to SaaS.
Yeah.
And so if you had sold Daily Journal because you thought newspapers were going out of business, you would have made a huge mistake.
Yeah, they like sort of suddenly load the boat with bank stocks.
that
was a bit of a turn, wasn't it?
Yeah, gee.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is changing tack slightly, but there's a couple of other interesting things that you do that we covered on the first podcast episode. So sort of the options is one component of it, but there's still the core value strategy. And there's a couple of, I guess, controversial stocks in the portfolio, I think, at the moment. One of which is Seritage Growth Properties, which I think a lot of people are probably finding quite difficult to continue owning at the moment. And it's getting, it seems like the story's kind of changing a little bit. It looks like, the initial plan at Seritage was redevelop the properties, hopefully increase the square footage, have multiples of the rent per square foot and so on. But it looks like they're potentially changing strategy possibly to liquidate the business.
Yes, I think so.
Are you willing to share any thoughts on what's going on at Seritage?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I'll say I think many of our positions are controversial.
I guess it's the way to be. The story of
a value investor is sort of, you have to kind of have a contrarian approach. And it doesn't necessarily need to be totally contrarian. It just needs to be a well thought out thesis that maybe everyone doesn't appreciate, because otherwise the price would be more accurate.
Sure.
There's a lot of uncertainty, which makes a lot of, for a lot of volatility. So to take a step back, there are, I don't know the exact count today, but very recently there were about 170 properties remaining. And I think now they're in the 160s, maybe 165. I have gone through from back when they had 212 and analyzed the price and value of all of their properties. So they're in different stages of construction. They're different levels of quality. They have different end use sort of ambition, objectives. And but we have a value for all of them. And they come out to be quite valuable, maybe call it in the $4 billion range. And then they have all of this kind of strange debt, about $1.4 billion, primarily to Berkshire. And when you work it all out and do get into the unit economics of all the details, you end up with high 20s per share. And that doesn't include all of these advantages that they have in terms of densification, ways they can use these massively overparked parking lot space. Each Sears is sort of like 13 acres or something. I mean, there's a lot of land and they can do a lot of different things with this. But they do need, they have a cash flow issue. So the challenge is they need to basically pay down some of their debt and they need to refinance some of their debt. And as you can imagine, interest rates are going up. So this is not without risk. This is, there are concerns. The major concern is that they run into some sort of a cash flow challenge, a liquidity issue that could fundamentally derail the business and put them into like bankruptcy type filings. Mm-hmm. So we are watching that very closely. But ultimately, they've brought in a new CFO who's a deal maker and a liquidator. They had a portfolio of roughly 70 or so properties that are the entire intention was to liquidate those properties. So they're definitely going to be liquidating those, raising cash through that process. They may try to sell the whole business. They may try to sell different, they would presumably be attempting to sell, groups of properties to strategic buyers.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what the final outcome is going to be, but there's a great management team. They're steering the ship right. The assets are worth a lot. We're just watching the cash flow issue. So, you know, if they can make it through July 2023 and get their $1.4 billion in debt down below $800 billion, which is just, you know, they just need $600 million and they have very, very high quality properties. They could sell a large property and maybe raise, definitely raise hundreds of millions with a single property sale. If they're able to do that and pay down Berkshire to 800, they've already received a 3-year extension on 800 from Berkshire.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the possibility of there being a real liquidity problem is low, but the price certainly moves around considerably. I it makes me uncomfortable when I receive input from people who are blindly buying because there are risks yeah. involved. And we're not even buying, we're selling puts. So the premiums are so high right now. The shares might sell for 10. I just mentioned, you know, they might be worth in the high 20s today, but I don't expect it. If they sold the whole business, they wouldn't receive that. They would get a small premium to current price, and then many shareholders might accept it. So maybe it sells for 15 or high teens. So we're selling puts with a strike of call it 10, and we can pick up $2.50, and they go out 8 months, and we'll probably earn 33% because the shares should not be selling at this level. But if there's a liquidity issue, their shares could drop considerably. So this is not without risk, and we're well aware and watching it very closely.
Yeah, cool. And I've done a lot of the same work with the grinding through property by property valuation. Mm-hmm. So I'm on board with that part. What do you make of the recent change away from a REIT status?
Yeah, that's interesting. And I guess a lot of their corporate governance and aspects have been very confusing.
Mm.
So part of the challenge with being a REIT is that there's only certain investors that are interested in REITs, and they're usually interested because they get the dividend yeah. And the tax benefits. Yeah. So for Seritage, which has, you know, no dividend because they don't have, you know, any NOI. Yeah. yeah. The REIT classification becomes quite confusing, almost the way that Eddie Lampert owned a whole bunch of units that were going to loot shares. That was also confusing. So, you know, there's a number of reasons they may be simplifying the business. But moving away from REIT status is just a fine decision. There's no dividend ramifications. I think it opens the portfolio up and the firm up to have more shareholder interest than previously. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. Do you have any take on Seritage?
It's not a business that I've looked into really that much at all. So I don't think I really have any take on it. The only thing I would say is, so through the process of you selling puts on it, I think obviously there's a significant risk that there's a risk that the stock goes to zero, for example, but it's actually even better, right, than you just buying the stock outright, because you're actually mm-hmm. buying it with the premium basically at a lower price than
correct
than the market bad. Price
correct yeah. And Hamish, it's the question you asked earlier with Activision. You asked if we ever do these things. Originally Seritage looked very attractive for a long period of time. In fact, by the time they started paying a dividend, in my mind, I thought that's when we exit, because they no longer have the ability to redeploy that capital into high IRR reinvestment opportunities. But we're now in a situation where we have been put some of the shares over the last year and a half or so that we've been selling puts. And as the shares run up, we're comfortable and able to sell calls. So we can have equity security that's moving between, say, $10 and $15 a share. And we have both calls and puts that we're selling on this that expire on the same day. So there cannot be, the shares can only be at one price on that expiration date. So we're sort of doubling up on our premiums in a way. So when it runs to 15, we'll sell a call for 17 and pick up $2. And that may expire in January 2023. And then when it falls to 10, we sell a put for the same amount of shares, we pick up another 250. They expire in 2023. The shares can be above 15 or below 10. They can't be in both places, but we've picked up $4.50.
Wow. Interesting.
And if, hypothetically, if Seritage does go through a full sale process and, you know, they sell enough properties to pay down the debt and then they start, I don't know exactly how it would look, but presumably they'd be special dividends and things starting to come out if they'd liquidated the whole thing. How's that affect your options?
That is a very good question. So corporate events do impact options in a major way. A lot of people don't anticipate that, and it can blindside people. Mm-hmm. So mergers, acquisitions, special dividends adjust the strike price for one.
Okay.
So a lot of times if there was a $2 special dividend that came out of Seritage, all of our strike prices would adjust by $2. That's gotcha. Most likely what the OCC would determine, but it becomes the regulatory body that writes a decision and they post it. And so their corporate event is announced, and then days or weeks later, a decision on what's going to happen to open options is announced. And sometimes it's favorable and sometimes it's not. So if you're an option holder, for example, in a different company, let's say you're a John Malone does all of these special warrants and things. So let's say you're a plain vanilla, you just own a call. Well, the warrants don't get allocated to that call. So you're not a shareholder. They just get they're just made available to shareholders. So you sometimes get cut out of good corporate event activity. So you need to be very careful. You need to watch those activities.
Yeah, and I guess some part of the story, and I guess you would maybe just classify this as you being wrong on the company, but something could fundamentally change in the business and the stock plummets based on it, and you're kind of put the shares at maybe a significantly higher price than what the stock is at, and maybe that changes the valuation, or it just changes the business fundamentally completely. I guess that would be the other
yes.
kind of risk.
There is that risk. It's the same risk as owning the underlying securities. Excuse me. However, there's one difference, which is that you've lowered your cost basis a bit. So back to the Seritage example, if it's selling for 10 and you pick up 250, if the shares fall to five, I think it would be very hard to see Seritage go to zero. I mean, the assets are there. They would need to do like, it would almost be a corrupt activity, which it's rare that it would happen in that way. For shares to go to zero, they would need to say they have no cash and it's fully bankrupt. And it would, I guess, ultimately move to Berkshire. And they're not a vulture investor, but they own the debt. So if they can't pay their debt, they would get all of these Sears plants. So instead, I think a terrible scenario would be that Seritage falls from 10 to 5 and then the business is done. Or something happens with some sort of a merger with like this stub of Sears that's controlled by ESL, and maybe there's some repurchase or like a bid that's under the market. Strange things can happen. But if the shares went from 10 to 5, your purchase price is 7.5. And we could turn around immediately and we could sell a call with a strike of $6 a share and maybe earn a dollar. So instead of buying it for 7, now we're kind of out at, if it bounces up to 6, we're out, and we're out at 7 with the premium.
Yeah.
So okay, we're really out 50 cents on a 7.50 purchase. So if you understand exactly what you're doing, even if something's declining, you can pull out of it pretty well and sometimes even make a profit.
Yeah.
Which is surprising. Yeah.
But that makes sense. You got to think of it as like an opportunity cost. Like if you were going to buy the stock anyway, just purely buy the stock, then relatively getting the shares at a 25% discount is actually better relatively.
And just so to be clear for your viewers, where my head's at, I would find it so irrational to buy the shares. It's a fine investment, but when you know that these contracts exist that allow you to lower the price, it doesn't even resonate with me to go out and buy this stock. I would never consider doing that. I would just always sell the puts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to add a lot more margin of safety, I guess.
It adds margin of safety in both the purchase and the sale, so that if there is a mistake, you pick, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Couple more specifics on Seritage, if I may. If you don't want to get into this stuff, let us know. But
that's fine.
I guess there's a couple of things that often come up when I make like Seritage videos on YouTube, you know, going through my valuation work or whatever. And one of them is, you know, these articles that pop up from time to time about litigation with Sears and, you know, Shield Q, I think is the ticker. Do those shareholders have some sort of claim to Seritage assets? And sort of a second part of that, I guess. There's been a few people sort of going along with the theory that Eddie Lampert has such a big shareholding in Seritage that he could basically, you know, pick the really premium properties that he wants to buy and get them at a bargain price, and that kind of leaves the minority shareholder kind of screwed over in a way. Do you have thoughts on either of those couple
these,
of issues?
No, these, you're going through the true risks. Mm. I think the risk of litigation is probably low. Okay, maybe there may be a small amount that gets paid at some point to settle everything. But realistically, the market price, the folks that are going to be determining the outcome of this litigation are going to be looking at the market price as a signal. It's different than how us value investors look at it, but they're going to say, well, if they spun it out at $35 a share, and now the price is $10 a share, why are you saying you didn't get paid adequately? Because clearly the value is far less than what they were paid. So it, in a weird way, the shares being down so much is
kind of helps.
It helps with the, it mitigates the litigation risk. If the shares were now trading for $200 a share, the Sears Q, whatever the ticker is now, right? Maybe they would have a more valid claim. They'd say it was spun out at 35 and it's clearly worth 200, right? Yep. But the opposite is true. So I don't worry much about the litigation. Lampert is a very smart corporate finance guru. So there is some fear. There is a risk that he would try to get a hold of some of the properties. There's there's also some potential that he could bring, he could do like a Sears 2.0 and bring it back together in some capacity. The last I understood is that he had sold out of his shares. So I'm not sure he converted his units to stock, and I believe he liquidated his stock. But unfortunately that puts him at a position where he's no longer affiliated. He could go out and make a bid. So these are the risks. These are the types of things we're watching. And so if, you know, if your viewers are saying, what about XYZ? I mean, they're right. You have to put probabilistic thinking on it. So, what's the probability of the, litigation going forward and really destroying the firm? I think it's very small. Mm-hmm. But it's not zero.
Yeah. A Seritage is a nice lesson for anyone watching that wants to study special situations and all the,
absolutely,
or sort of follow along with the story over time.
Yeah, I'll have to get back tonight and get the annual reports out.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing your thoughts on that, Matt. Appreciate it. It's another one of these controversial stocks that there's a wide range of views on Seritage, and I think particularly with a lot of the people that have been in the past, like Monash and Phil Town. There's a lot of people that follow those guys very closely. I'm wearing the Monash shirt even for this one.
I'll just conclude it by sharing the assets are worth far more than the current enterprise value. I don't think anybody questions that.
Agreed.
The question is, can they get over the cash flow hurdles that they might encounter before those assets are recognized?
Yeah.
And so that's what people are really debating.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think we've got about 15 minutes left. So one other topic we're keen to cover with you, again, which is quite a unique kind of thing you're doing, is investing in Turkey, a place
Keep it controversial.
Yeah, a place that has some, some interesting businesses, and you can maybe tell us about that, but it sort of has this big macro overhang of high inflation, high interest rates.
Yeah.
We call
them unconventional economic policy.
There you go. Yeah. So I mean, what attracts you to Turkey in the first place? And do those factors play into how you analyze businesses over there at all? Or are you still very sort of focused on the micro?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Turkey is great hunting grounds for a value investor, but you need to be really familiar with what you're doing because there's so many unique aspects when you get into these developing markets. So my wife is Turkish. I've spent a lot of my adult life in Turkey. And about, let's say, 7-8 years ago, through Guy Spears ValueX conference in Switzerland, mm-hmm. I was introduced to Mesut Eliotolu, who's like the number one Turkish equity analyst globally. He was the head of ABN AMRO's. He was the investment officer for ABN AMRO Turkey. He has been focused on the same 400 equities for a successful 30-year career. And 200 of them you don't touch anyway. So there's like 200 firms that he's been evaluating. And it's shocking the knowledge that he has. I mean, he knows the C-suites and their predecessors and their predecessor's predecessor. And I really get the deep sense when he walks in the room, people are intimidated by Mesut because he knows the company better than the
new CEO.
That said, as you mentioned, they're in a sort of a it's a controversial place in the world. Erdogan is a very controversial figure, political leader, and these unconventional policies that I joked about is that they're going through like massive inflation. There's currency depreciation. And when inflation happens in Turkey, when inflation happens anywhere in the world, economic 101 is that you raise interest rates, you lower the money supply, and then there's less demands for a given good, and it could slow your inflation, and hopefully it does.
Mm-hmm.
In Turkey, when there's high inflation, they just lower interest rates, and it creates a positive feedback loop, which is horrible for the economy.
Wow.
So, or I guess maybe you'd call it a negative feedback loop, but it's inflationary.
Yeah.
So they're putting inflationary policy on top of an already inflationary environment. And guess what? It didn't work. So, 15 years ago, it was about 1.3 lira for a dollar. And today it's about 15 lira for a dollar. So you can imagine a scenario where like your currency just depreciates 90%. And so these are all factors. We are well aware that we don't hedge the currency. We are well aware that the currency is a depreciating asset, and there's unconventional economic policies that are pushing it in that direction. So we are focused so much on the microeconomic factors. So if you're in that scenario, we're looking at businesses that have like a global footprint. So maybe they're earning euros in revenue. They're earning, their revenue is coming in dollars. Their revenue is coming in euros, but their expenses are in lira. So their costs are going down and their revenue is stable. Also, we're looking at really solid global companies that are trading on the Bursa exchange. So as the lira falls, they just naturally become cheaper. We are spending dollars to make these purchases. So if the lira gets cut in half, the companies we were looking to buy just get cut in half. Further, foreign investors leave. So there's almost a decline. If they just sell the index, there might be a decline in the general price. So in Turkey, we are finding opportunities where you can truly capture like PEs of one. You can find things trading for 3x earnings, 4x wow. earnings. And you need to be comfortable with volatility because the prices are not efficient. They're inefficient. So information doesn't flow as quickly as they would in a developed market. So, and that's why these opportunities exist. So Masut and I launched a separate fund from Peterson a few years ago called Talis. And you can go to Talis and we lay out all the companies we own, and they're just spectacular. So sometimes it's hard to get in. You would need a special tax ID and things like that. But you're able to purchase a few of the bigger ones if you like it. They're exceptional opportunities over there.
Yeah. Is there a concern that, I mean, these businesses are really cheap on a valuation basis. Is there a concern or is there a catalyst that you look for the market to kind of become more efficient? Because obviously looking at the US market, for example, you might see an inefficiency and you're hoping that over the next few years that gap is kind of closed. Is that something that you treat differently in Turkey? Is it the same? Like, how do you kind of navigate that?
That's a wonderful question. So, we do sort of need catalysts. It's a different type of investing when you're in emerging markets. So, because the prices could be wrong for a long time, and you have to sit there and wait, and you're sort of, it impacts your annualized IRR while you're waiting. Mm-hmm. I will share with you a situation in the current environment. We were just out talking with Anadolu Hayat, which is one of the largest insurers, and they're moving into all these pensions and asset management businesses. It's a great company. The chairman, we met with the chair and C-suite. The chairman used to be the CEO of Isbank. And to put it in perspective, it's sort of like you're sort of just talking to Jamie Dimon. And we're sitting there, we bring a tour over. So we did a tour in January. And there's about 10 of us just asking him questions, explaining all sorts of things. And we get to hear this from multiple individuals, but coming from him, it's quite interesting where he says, basically, he explained to us that, and we already knew this a little bit, but he confirmed this. There's an election scheduled for next year. Now, Erdogan, we're not sure what's going to happen. Erdogan's had a way of maintaining his power. But they've put in place so many of these unorthodox policies and seen them fail. That even the current administration knows that it was a mistake. They just can't go back on it until the election because they will lose their base. So what we were told is that no matter who wins the election in March, we will move to conventional economic policy. So we will start to now raise interest rates to counteract inflation. We will treat, you know, the economy as it should be treated. Rather than sort of experimenting and shooting from the hip. So the catalyst for a lot of these opportunities is going to come next March. Now, the election could be pulled early. They could just announce that they're going to make an election, and then, you know, the incumbent has the advantage. So maybe they announce that they're going to do an election in August. Or it could be postponed a little bit. But the election will occur. And once that election happens, many of our holdings could, like, triple overnight. because they're just so mispriced. If you get a good stable business selling for 3 or 4 times earnings, it can just readjust and sell for 8 or 9. And these are growing companies also.
That's crazy. And we've just got the 5% battery signal, so we'd better get through my last question, which is completely unrelated to Turkey. But I know you're a big Daily Journal man. Mm. There's been a lot of speculation around why Munga might have cut his barber steak in half. Do you have any final thoughts on why that might have happened?
You know, I think it's I wouldn't put anything at 100% or 0%.
Sure.
But I think it's almost unequivocal that this was a tax loss harvest, and I think it's amazing how many people speculate. Was yeah. Like, what he did is he just did the opposite of how most people think about tax loss harvesting. So he, instead of selling, and then in the U.S. we're required to be out of the security for 30 days to avoid these like wash sale rules. Mm-hmm. Instead of taking that approach, he actually just bought first, waited till the next quarter. So he waited however many days, and then he sold the original position. And it's almost dollar for dollar. He almost doubled it and then cut it in half.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think he changed his opinion. I think what Munger would be a probabilistic thinker. And so he logically understood that for him to be out of the stock would put him at great risk of missing a big upside. And so he would rather be doubly exposed to that potential. There's asymmetry in where the shares go from here. Mm. There's much greater potential for upside moves than downside moves. So he was more comfortable buying in twice and then selling later to capture his tax loss.
Yep.
And I worked out that he probably saved in present value terms about $4 million for Daily Journal, which doesn't seem like much, but you have to imagine this only has a $35 million in revenue.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So if you, $4 million is tangible.
Yeah. Because he sold the exact amount of shares, I think, that he bought in the first and third quarter or whatever it was, first two purchases that he made. So it's just interesting to see that he did it in reverse. And he used margin as well, right? He took a little bit of margin on and then,
margin bought at like 0.75%.
Nothing.
it was 50 bips over risk-free rate.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people at first were wondering what is going on, and then the next quarter it kind of made sense why he did that. Yeah.
Interesting.
It was quite interesting, and it's amazing how many people are speculating on different aspects. To me, it looks so clearly like a tax loss harvest. It's, I think that's all it is.
Yeah. Mm. We heard it here first. Matt, thanks so much for your time. We're about to run out of camera battery, and Hamish, thanks for riding along on this one. That was good fun. But Matt, great to chat with you in person this time. And,
in person, it's wonderful.
Peterson HQ in Austin, Texas, and we'll have to come back another year. You're telling us with your actuarial tables that Warren and Charlie got a couple of years yet. Hopefully,
start booking your flights now.
Well, thank you very much. And just finally, for anyone that does want to follow along with what you're doing, where can they go to check you out?
Yeah, absolutely. PetersonFunds.com is the website. So anybody can go there and see all sorts of, you know, letters for 10 years and all sorts of writing. And we also have a YouTube channel, so you can search Peterson Capital Management and it'll probably lead you to our channel. Talus is taluscapital.com if anybody's interested in some of the stuff we're doing over in Turkey.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. That will all be linked down in the description below, and we'll see you in the next episode.